By statute, when a defendant succeeds in having a conviction or sentence set aside, the trial court may not impose a more severe sentence for the same offense. But the courts recognize an exception to that rule when the prior sentence was not authorized by law. The North Carolina Supreme Court has now upheld a harsher sentence imposed at resentencing when the prior sentence resulted from an error in the determination of the defendant's prior record level. We'll be discussing that case, State v. Thomas, today. I'm Joseph Hyde with the University of North Carolina School of Government.
And I'm Jonathan Holbrook with the North Carolina Conference of DAs.
And this is Turning States, a podcast for North Carolina prosecutors and others interested in the criminal justice system in North Carolina.
Joe, it seems like just about every episode lately, we're covering another case involving these defensive force statutes. So let's start out talking about State v. Cole.
State v. Cole. This was a case out of Mecklenburg County. There's a lot of facts in the opinion. I'm kind of going to cut to the chase here. Back in November 9th of 2019, defendant was ejected by the occupants of a drug house in Charlotte. He got into his car, drove around for a little while, but he came back about 15 or 20 minutes later. Defendant found two people, Furhan Morrow and Doug Bolton, in the backyard. He shot both men, killing Morrow. Defendant then went inside the house and shot two other people, Tilden Hoyle and Janet Scrantz, and Scrantz was killed as a result of that shooting. Defendant was indicted for two counts of murder, two counts of attempted murder, and one count of discharging a firearm within an enclosure to incite fear. The matter came on for trial by jury in July of 2023. At the charge conference, defendant requested instructions on self-defense for the charges related to the backyard shooting. He also requested instruction on the defense of accident for the shootings that took place inside of the house. The trial court agreed to instruct on self-defense, but it also included the felony disqualifier provision. The trial court denied the requested instruction on the defense of accident. Defendant was convicted of all charges, sentenced to two terms of life, two terms of 144 to 185 months, and, significant to the opinion, for discharging a firearm within an enclosure, he was sentenced to an additional 15 to 27 months, and the defendant appealed. Before the Court of Appeals, defendant raised five issues. Two of them dealing with the sufficiency of the state's evidence for those charges, two of them dealing with the jury instructions, one about the felony disqualifier and one about the accident instruction. And then the fifth issue had to do with the trial court's imposing a separate sentence for the conviction for discharging a firearm within an enclosure. With regard to the sufficiency of the evidence challenges, the Court of Appeals makes pretty short work of these. Defendant argued that the state failed to present sufficient evidence of his intent to kill Doug Bolton. The Court of Appeals recognized that specific intent to kill is an element of attempted murder. It said intent to kill may be inferred from a defendant's conduct and statements, any ill will or previous difficulty between the parties, evidence regarding the manner of the attempted killing. Here, after shooting Morrow, defendant turned his gun on Bolton. He chased Bolton into a storage closet. Bolton was apparently cowering down, pleading for his life. Defendant shot him anyway. The Court of Appeals found the evidence was, quote, undoubtedly sufficient to withstand the defendant's motion to dismiss the charge of attempted murder of the victim, Doug Bolton. Defendant also argued that the evidence was insufficient to show discharging a firearm within an enclosure to incite fear. And similar to his challenge to the evidence of attempted murder, he challenged specifically the state's evidence of his intent, in this case, his intent to incite fear. Under General Statute 14-34.10, any person who willfully or wantonly discharges a firearm within an occupied enclosure with the intent to incite fear is guilty of a Class F felony. I think this is the first Court of Appeals case to hold that for purposes of that offense, that discharging a firearm within an enclosure requires a showing of specific intent. The Court of Appeals said the state must prove not only that the defendant willfully or wantonly discharged a firearm within an enclosure, but that he did so with the specific intent to incite fear in another person. The Court of Appeals recognized that intent usually must be proved by circumstantial evidence, and here circumstances include the foreseeable consequences of an act. As the Court of Appeals said, the defendant must be held to intend the normal and natural consequences of his conduct. In this case, after shooting Morrow and Bolton, defendant entered the house and resumed shooting. The Court of Appeals said chaos ensued. There were nine people in the kitchen, and there was evidence that these people in the kitchen stampeded to get out of the kitchen. Several hid in the bathroom. Defendant goes through the house, and there's evidence that other people heard other shots going off. The Court of Appeals found the evidence was sufficient for the jury to find that the defendant incited fear. The issue that really captured my interest, and this is one that I've blogged about on the Criminal Law Blog, is this question about the trial court's jury instruction on the felony disqualifier provision. Defendant argued the trial court erred by instructing on the felony disqualifier limitation on self-defense. Under General Statute 14-51.3, a person is justified in using deadly force and has no duty to retreat if he reasonably believes such force is necessary to prevent imminent death or great bodily harm. But under General Statute 14-51.4, this justification is not available to a person who is committing a felony. The North Carolina Supreme Court, in a case called State v. McLemore, that was back in 2022, held that to disqualify a defendant based on his commission of a felony, the state must prove the existence of an immediate causal nexus between the disqualifying conduct and the use of force that gave rise to the claim of self-defense. Here, the trial court instructed the jury that the defendant would not be entitled to use defensive force if he was committing felony breaking and entering, discharging a firearm within an enclosure to incite fear, or murder, attempted murder of the other victims, and that that felony was immediately causally connected to the circumstances giving rise to the use of defensive force. The argument that the defendant made, and this is not crazy, is that he could not be disqualified from self-defense by felonies that he had not yet committed. So he was alleging self-defense for the shootings in the backyard, and the trial court said that he would not be justified in using self-defense if those occurred during the commission of these felonies that occurred inside the house. The Court of Appeals, however, rejected that argument. It said nowhere in McLemore did the Supreme Court suggest that there was a specific temporal component to the felony disqualifier beyond the statutory requirement of an immediate causal nexus. In fact, it said defendant's argument contradicts McLemore, where McLemore was talking about an armed robbery that took place, the taking in McLemore being committed after the shooting that gave rise to the claim of self-defense. The Court of Appeals concluded in this case that the trial court did not err by delivering a felony disqualifier instruction.
Okay, Joe, I have a question. So, I mean, in a case like this, it might be a little easier to wrap our heads around that, right? I mean, you know, there is the first incident in the backyard. That does seem pretty tied up with the then breaking into and shooting all these other people in the house. It does kind of feel like one event, but they're saying, like you mentioned, they're saying there is no temporal component to the causal nexus. So, I mean, my question for you is, let's say two people just get in a fight, they're struggling over the weapon, and he ends up shooting the victim in the case and then runs from the scene because he's freaked out and, you know, has this subsequent charge of felony fleeing to elude. There's a causal nexus between the two things that happened, but, you know, obviously the other one is just totally separate, totally after. Would the fleeing to elude from the shooting be a causally nexus connected felony that would disqualify him from the shooting that happened before that led to the fleeing to elude?
Yeah, I mean, that's really the question coming out of Cole, because Cole makes it sound like it would be possible to do that kind of connection, and that any felony that took place kind of in the same circumstances could disqualify the defendant from the previous use of defensive force. I would caution prosecutors not to push that too far. And I think the rationale here, by tying it back to McLemore, in a footnote in McLemore, the Supreme Court recognized the continuous transaction doctrine. The continuous transaction doctrine is one that's used in felony murder, but also in armed robbery, that generally means a defendant is not going to be excused from a taking or a felony that happened after the killing if the killing and the felony are so intimately tied up as to be part of a continuing transaction, one continuous course of conduct. That, I think, explains the result here, because the Court of Appeals, by citing McLemore, was basically saying, look, you can't really make a legitimate argument that these felonies were so separated in time and circumstances that the felonies, albeit later in time, were not somehow connected to the shooting that took place in the backyard. Now, whether you're going to be able to use that in a situation like you described, where it's a circumstance of potentially self-defense and then a fleeing from that, or a self-defense situation and felonies occurring, days later or weeks later, like I said, I would be reluctant to push that further than it will go. I think the limiting principle is that might be permissible in a situation as in Cole, where there is a continuous transaction. But if there's some argument that there's been a break in the chain of events, it's not going to work to say that those later felonies precluded the defendant from using defensive force at an earlier time. Just real quickly, the last two issues in this case, the defendant argued that the trial court erred by denying his request for an instruction on defensive accident. He claimed that his version of events described a struggle over the gun once he had gotten into the house. The Court of Appeals, again, rejected that. It said the defense of accident is triggered when a defendant without premeditation, intent, or culpable negligence commits acts that bring about the death of another. When the defendant was not engaged in lawful conduct, when the killing occurred, the evidence does not give rise to the defense of accident. And importantly, a bare assertion that the shooting was unintentional does not give rise to a defense of accident. Here, the evidence shows that the defendant, as the Court of Appeals said, created the conditions that led to the shooting. He returned armed after being asked to leave, and that the defendant offered scant evidence beyond his own testimony to support his claim of accident. The Court of Appeals concluded the trial court did not err by denying his request for instructions. And further, even if assuming that the trial court erred by not giving this accident instruction, defendant failed to show prejudice. The last issue in the case is whether the trial court erred by imposing a separate sentence for discharging a firearm within an enclosure to incite fear. Defendant claimed he was subject to double jeopardy. That statute for discharging a firearm to incite fear, General Statute 14-34.10, has what's called, what I have called, a some other provision of law provision. This is something that I've blogged about. The statute says the defendant may be convicted of discharging a firearm within an enclosure unless the conduct is covered by some other provision of law providing greater punishment. And it's true that there are Court of Appeals cases that interpret that as a double jeopardy provision, basically saying you can't be double sentenced both for this conduct and other conduct. The Court of Appeals here said defendant failed to raise a constitutional issue at trial, and as a result of that, it was not going to address this constitutional issue for the first time on appeal. It recognized that under Appellate Rule 2, an appellate court may, in exceptional circumstances, suspend the rules and address issues that had not been properly preserved. Here, however, the Court of Appeals concluded this was not the exceptional case warranting suspension of the rules and declined to invoke Rule 2 to reach the merits of that issue. The reason that's a little curious is that there are other Court of Appeals cases that recognize this some other provision of law clause as not a double jeopardy provision, but as merely an indication of legislative intent. And we know that generally sentencing issues do not have to be preserved by contemporaneous objection for a reviewing court to address them. So I feel like here, this is potentially a situation where the defendant just got tripped up in his own advocacy, relying on those double jeopardy cases, as opposed to that other line of cases addressing the same issue that treats this not as a constitutional issue, but merely as a sentencing provision. And the consequences of that some other provision of law clause might come out differently in a different case.
Yeah, I don't know how often we would see that particular issue raised, but certainly be keeping our eye out for some future cases on this interesting causal nexus question as well.
Right, absolutely.
So the second case we had on is also from the Court of Appeals, also from April 1st of 2026. This case is State v. Williams, a case from Mecklenburg County. It came to light back on September 30th of 2020. Officers had been doing some surveillance on the defendant's residence, had done some control buys of drugs, and they, based on all of that probable cause that they've developed, they end up doing a search of the defendant's residence on him and some other persons who are present. From that search, they end up finding several plastic bags containing a powdery, sandy-type substance, some of that inside a safe in the garage, others that are found on the defendant or on other individuals who were there at the property. Those are, of course, tested and turn out to be in different quantities of drugs containing tramadol, fentanyl, other drugs. One of them 65-some grams, another one a little over a gram, another one in the defendant's front right pocket that was 5.7 grams. So based on all of that, the defendant was indicted in a couple of cases for trafficking by possession of 28 grams or more of fentanyl. Also trafficking by possession of 4 to 14 grams of fentanyl. And then that case went to trial beginning on January 5th of 2024. Two things of note that came up at the trial. One of those is that one of the officers in the case, Sergeant Slaughter, gave some testimony about what was observed in the garage while they were executing the search. And as part of that, mentioned that he saw a photo of the defendant hanging in the garage and that he recognized that as being a photo of the defendant because he had also seen the mugshot of the defendant that was attached to a report. The defendant objected to that. That was sustained. Witness was taken on voir dire, and then there was some clarifying testimony that was offered in front of the jury later to clarify that what the detective or what the sergeant meant by referring to a mugshot was that he had seen a digital photo of the defendant. It was attached to the KB Cops report, the incident report for this incident. So that was sort of clarified for the jury afterwards. But that is one of the issues.
In other words, this didn't come from a prior offense that he'd been convicted of, right? This wasn't a mugshot that the cops had in their file because this guy's a continuing criminal.
Exactly. And the fears arising from that are sort of what the defendant is arguing on appeal about, you know, what the jury would think he meant by that is part of the basis of that first issue that's being raised on appeal. The second one has to do with the prosecutor's closing argument in the case. The prosecutor, in arguing to the jury at the closing about the seriousness of fentanyl and why they should take the case seriously and convict the defendant included basically holding up one of those bags, that large 65-gram bag of fentanyl, tramadol, and a couple of other substances, and explaining to the jury that 1/1,000th of a gram can be a lethal dose of fentanyl, and here I am holding 65 grams in my hand. And so then the prosecutor said, that is why this is serious. That is why you should take this seriously. This is the drug. This is the fentanyl that is in your community. And then went on to say a couple of, I think, in your schools as well. And once again, the defendant objected to that. The objection was sustained. And then the prosecutor just sort of revised that comment and just said, that's why this is important. This is why your job as jurors is important. And so asking them to do what they are bound to do. They did that. The defendant was found guilty of both of those charges for the trafficking, was sentenced and ultimately appealed, presenting these two issues, arguing about the mugshot and the closing argument that was made by the prosecutor. You know, the court ultimately resolves both of these issues in kind of a similar fashion. You know, they talk about this mugshot issue and they acknowledge, Joe, exactly what you were talking about. That could be prejudicial for something to come in about, referencing these prior arrests that he's had, because in a sense, that is inviting the jury to convict him based on suspicion of prior bad acts rather than the evidence that is actually being presented to the jury here. And so they talk about how. But again, that objection was sustained. It was made by the defense and it was sustained. What he's appealing is the denial of his motion for a mistrial based on what had happened, even though the objection was sustained. And particularly first for this mugshot, the Court of Appeals says no, that was not error to decline to grant a mistrial on that basis.
Jonathan, let me ask you, what is the relevance of that photograph? Because didn't the officer say something, I recognized the defendant's picture on the wall in the house from his mugshot or something like that? Why did the prosecutor present that at all?
Right. That was not totally clear to me either, just from reading the opinion. But I went back and glanced at the briefs that were filed in the case. And as I understand it, I think this property, the house, the garage, you know, there were other individuals there. There was an administrative assistant who worked for the defendant. And I think this garage was also kind of an office or even a residence for that person. And so I think that was what we were getting at, is that a large quantity of these drugs were found in a safe in the garage. So I would imagine the state was offering that as, you know, further evidence to show that this defendant is the one who's in constructive possession of these drugs. This is sort of his office, you know, a space he controls. And so, you know, they were establishing the connection between him and that space. And so that's why they were referencing the photo. But, you know, again, on that issue, yes, it would be generally, I guess, improper for the state to talk to the jury about prior arrests that if we're not having a, you know, a 404B basis to get into it or something like that. But in terms of this appeal, was it error not to grant a mistrial? The Court of Appeals says no. It is a well-settled principle. One may not suffer prejudice where his objections are sustained. In other words, the judge didn't let that in. You know, I mean, the objection was sustained. The jury's at least, if they're following the instructions, as we presume that they are, then they are not considering that. And then on top of that, it was clarified anyway by the prosecutor to make it clear to them, I'm not even talking about some prior mugshot. I'm talking about a photo attached to a report from this case, which would then further remove the chance of any prejudice occurring. The second objection was, again, dealing with that closing argument where the prosecutor made those comments about the more complete version of it was, that's why this is serious. That's why you should take this seriously. This is the drug. This is the fentanyl that is in your community. It's in your schools. It's in your, and then the objection, and that objection is sustained. And the defendant characterizes this as saying it was improper because the prosecutor was asking the jury to act as an ear to the community. That's sort of what they quote from the defendant's appellate brief.
Jonathan, did the Court of Appeals address the propriety of this argument? I mean, did it even go into whether this was permissible for the prosecutor to say or not?
We don't get a deep discussion about exactly why, you know, whether that would or would not be proper. I mean, they certainly, I don't think we're doing anything here to disturb the law. And that's probably worth talking about, Joe, that, you know, we have established case law that says we can tell the jury that they should act as the voice or even the conscience of the community, you know, that you need to send a message, you need to protect the community. That's why you need to convict this defendant. As the defendant argues, we can't ask the jury to lend an ear to the community. You know, I want you to convict this defendant because the people out there want you to. You know, that's not what we're going to ask them to do. That would be improper. They should be deciding this case based on the evidence and the facts that have been presented to them. But again, sort of like the mugshot issue, they make the point of saying, assuming that is improper, That objection was sustained. And then the prosecutor moved on, rephrasing the argument to just say, hey, this is important. You need to do your job and protect the community. They said that with the evidence presented to the jury, the state's improper statements during closing argument referencing fentanyl in your communities and in your schools do not raise a reasonable possibility the jury would have acquitted the defendant if the state's remarks had been excluded to constitute irreparable prejudice. So, you know, there would have had to be more here for them to say it was error not to grant the mistrial in light of the fact that the objection was sustained. You know, Joe, one of the things that stood out for me a little bit is, you know, the way the defendant is phrasing this argument, you know, saying that it's improper because I'm asking you to lend an ear to the community. I don't know, the way that I read that, I guess if I were his attorney, that's not even necessarily the argument I would have made. This idea of, hey, jury, you should be scared because this is the fentanyl that's in your community, your schools. This feels more like edging into that other thing that we do not want to do as prosecutors in closing arguments, which is asking the jury to put themselves in the shoes of a victim or something like that. I mean, either way, to the extent that it was improper to sort of, I don't know, attempt to rattle the jury by saying, hey, this is your community, your schools, that objection was sustained. And so they did not see any sufficient risk of prejudice here that they would say it was error for the trial judge to decline to declare a mistrial. So, you know, a takeaway from prosecutors, I guess we've said this in a number of cases, it comes up. Closing arguments are tough. I mean, it is, you know, you're passionate, you're advocating for the state, and sometimes things just kind of slip out. But particularly when it's that sort of directly talking to the jury and saying you or your to the jury, we just want to be careful and make sure we're phrasing it the right way and not asking them to consider something they shouldn't.
I guess the other takeaway, too, is in appropriate circumstances, if you've got a defendant who's had objections sustained and then turns around and asks the trial court for a mistrial, this case is going to provide good authority for saying, look, the defendant got the remedy that he was requesting. A mistrial is not warranted because you sustained those objections.
Absolutely. We're not going to go down a road where every sustained objection, you know, warrants a mistrial. We're going to presume that the jury will follow the judge's instructions. And if the objection is sustained, they're not considering that. And that's ultimately, I think, basically how they're resolving this case.
Last case we had on for today was State v. Thomas. This was a North Carolina Supreme Court case from March 20, 2026, case out of Guilford County. The facts are not, the Supreme Court doesn't go extensively into the facts. You got to kind of look back at the earlier Court of Appeals opinion. The short version is in January of 2019, defendant was involved in a string of motor vehicle and credit card thefts in the High Point area. In July of 2019, defendant was indicted for 14 substantive charges, 3 counts of false pretenses, 3 counts of financial transaction card theft, 2 counts of breaking and entering a motor vehicle, felony larceny, possession of a stolen motor vehicle, felony fleeing to elude arrest, 3 counts of misdemeanor larceny, and habitual felon status. The matter came on for trial by jury in February of 2020. Defendant waived counsel and proceeded pro se. He was convicted of 13 charges, which the trial court consolidated into 2 judgments. So this is ultimately a sentencing case, and we'll pay attention, a little more attention to what those judgments were. In one judgment structured around the felony larceny conviction, the trial court determined the defendant was a prior record level 3 and sentenced him to 67 to 93 months. That judgment is not at issue on appeal. In the other judgment structured around the conviction for breaking and entering a motor vehicle, the trial court found 9 prior record level points, determined the defendant was a prior record level 3 offender, and sentenced him to 26 to 44 months. The defendant appealed to the Court of Appeals, and by opinion issued February 25th, 2022, the Court of Appeals held the trial court erred by accepting the defendant's waiver of counsel and ordered a new trial. The matter came on for retrial in August 2022. Defendant was convicted this time of 8 charges. Again, the trial court consolidated the convictions into 2 judgments. One of those judgments was the same as before, 67 to 93 months. That one's not at issue on appeal. In the other judgment, again, structured around the conviction for breaking and entering a motor vehicle, the trial court this time found 10 prior record level points. It added an additional point in this iteration because all of the elements of the present offense were included in a prior offense. It determined based on that that the defendant was a prior record level 4 offender and sentenced him to 30 to 48 months. So in that second judgment, he got a higher sentence. Defendant appealed again to the Court of Appeals. Before the Court of Appeals, he argued that the trial court violated General Statute 15A-1335 when it imposed a more severe sentence upon resentencing. The Court of Appeals rejected that argument in August of 2024, and the defendant filed a petition for discretionary review with the North Carolina Supreme Court. North Carolina Supreme Court granted review. So under General Statute 15A-1335, that's really what this case is about, when a conviction or sentence imposed in Superior Court has been set aside, the court may not impose a new sentence for the same offense or for a different offense based on the same conduct, which is more severe than the prior sentence. There's a provision under structured sentencing, however, that says the minimum term of imprisonment shall be within the range specified for the class of offense and prior record level unless applicable statutes require or authorize another minimum sentence. The appellate courts have generally recognized an implied exception to 15A-1335. It's been interpreted as not precluding a more severe sentence when the prior sentence is unauthorized by law. In other words, if the original sentence was illegal, then there's no prohibition on the trial courts imposing a more severe sentence on remand or on resentencing. But there's an earlier North Carolina Supreme Court case called State v. Wagner, and that really forms the battleground of the dispute before the Supreme Court here. In Wagner, the Supreme Court held that when the defendant initially received a lawful mitigated range sentence pursuant to his plea agreement, but the trial court at resentencing imposed a higher presumptive range sentence, that 15A-1335 was an applicable statute that required another minimum sentence under structured sentencing, under that provision of 15A-1340.13 that says you have to impose a sentence within the range unless some other sentence requires or authorizes another minimum sentence. So this case really involves the interplay of those two statutes and whether and in what circumstances 1335 plays into that provision under structured sentencing that requires or authorizes another minimum sentence. I will point out that in 2013, so after Wagner, the statute 1335 was amended to say this section does not apply when a defendant succeeds in having a plea of guilty vacated. The circumstances in Wagner were such that the defendant had received a mitigated sentence pursuant to a plea agreement and then challenged that in a motion for appropriate relief and on resentencing got a presumptive range sentence because the trial court simply didn't find mitigating factors. So the Supreme Court in Thomas, the present case, recognized that the issue is whether 15A-1335 prohibited the trial court from resentencing defendant to a harsher prison term. It recognized that under a provision of structured sentencing, one additional prior record level point is assessed if all the elements of the present offense are included in a prior offense. It said that is a mandatory provision. It's not discretionary. The trial court has to do that. Here, at the first sentencing, the trial court, quote, erroneously determined that the defendant had 9 prior record level points. At the second sentencing hearing, the trial court correctly calculated that the defendant had 10 prior record level points. It said the trial court's failure to include the 10th point during defendant's first sentencing was error that resulted in the imposition of an illegal sentence. The consequence of that was that 15A-1335 would not preclude a harsher sentence here. The North Carolina Supreme Court majority acknowledged that a literal interpretation of 15A-1335 would prohibit a harsher sentence, but under binding precedent, illegal sentences may be corrected at resentencing, notwithstanding 15A-1335. The North Carolina distinguished Wagner as a case involving sentences that were both within the authorized range. The first was a lawful mitigated range sentence. The second was a lawful presumptive range sentence. So it said Wagner does not require a different result in this case. Now, there were 2 dissenting opinions, one from Justice Dietz and a second dissenting opinion from Justice Riggs and Justice Earls. It was Justice Riggs' opinion joined by Justice Earls. The point made by Justice Dietz was that he agreed that 15A-1335 recognizes an exception because courts are generally not permitted to impose an illegal sentence. He disagreed with the majority that the original sentence in this case was illegal. The legal principle that Justice Dietz relied on was the proposition known as the law of the case. He said the miscalculated prior record level was not an error, but became the law of the case when the state failed to appeal that sentence and get it corrected the first time. So because that was sort of baked into the proceeding by the time it goes back for resentencing, he said as a result, the trial court was required to adhere to 15A-1335 and impose the same sentence on remand because the initial sentence was not illegal as one between the parties in this case.
Joe, I thought that dissent was pretty interesting. I mean, you know, it's a different take on this whole big issue. I mean, I understand the conflict we're dealing with, right? If we have one statute that says you must not give a more harsh sentence than they got the first time around, but then we have another statute that says you must give a sentence that is permitted by law for the offense level and the prior record level, then we have that tension. And then sort of the way out of it is to say, well, but in this case, the sentence was illegal. But I think he makes an interesting point. It it may have been incorrectly calculated the first time around, but that's not exactly the same thing as an illegal sentence, right?
I mean, that's what's fascinating. If you look back at the case laws and it's primarily from the Court of Appeals that have interpreted this, but an illegal sentence is one, for example, where they tried to sentence the defendant independently as an habitual felon, and he had gotten a shorter sentence for the substantive felony. The Supreme Court said, no, habitual felon alone does not support an independent sentence. They sent it back, and he got a longer sentence for the substantive felony.
Yeah, or, you know, given that this person is a level 3 and convicted of a class D, we're giving them a term that is higher than is permitted, you know, on the sentencing grid or something like that. Then, you know, sure, that's illegal. But just to say, you know what, we might have done the math wrong.
Right.
To say, well, that's the law of the case and nobody appealed it. Yeah. And so we're stuck with that. It's an interesting take.
The point to make there is that Justice Dietz's dissent, at any rate, is focused primarily on the procedural aspect. The longer dissent by Justice Riggs, joined by Justice Earls, kind of makes two different arguments, and they're not cleanly separated in this long dissent, but I take it to be there's a procedural argument, such as the one Justice Dietz accepted, but also a substantive argument. The procedural argument is the state's failure to preserve this issue and appeal the alleged error at the first sentencing precluded the Supreme Court from, as the dissent said, addressing that error and correcting that error the second time around. But the substantive issue, aside from that procedural concern, is that the dissent said 15A.1340.13b anticipates that other applicable statutes may require or authorize a different sentence. The applicable statute in defendant's case was 15A-1335. In other words, they wholeheartedly endorsed that rationale in Wagner and saying these statutes can be reconciled by saying structured sentencing actually requires a lesser sentence in a situation like this where a prior sentence had resulted in a lower penalty. The dissent was also concerned about the rationale for the enactment of that statute. It followed on a U.S. Supreme Court case called North Carolina v. Pierce, and it was enacted to prevent, basically, prosecutorial vindictiveness, coming after a defendant and penalizing him for exercising his right to appeal. The dissent, I think, is concerned about the potential chilling effect on appeals moving forward. A defendant gets basically a lucky break. The trial court makes a mistake at sentencing. Say the trial was riddled with errors. He's going to be more reluctant to appeal that, knowing that the trial court coming back the second time might impose a harsher sentence on the theory that the first sentence was illegal. So I guess the takeaway for prosecutors is that if you've got one of these situations where a defendant is back up for resentencing, if he's successfully appealed or successfully got a conviction or sentence vacated as a result of a motion for appropriate relief, this is an issue to look out for, right? That 1335 is generally going to preclude the trial court from imposing a harsher sentence than the defendant got the first time, except in those rare circumstances where there's a plausible argument that the first sentence was not authorized by law.
Yeah. And I think important for prosecutors to know, I mean, not that we would ever try to be vindictive and punish somebody for, you know, pursuing a proper appeal, but that second time around, if we realize we got something wrong on the sentencing, then I think this case is saying we do get this kind of second chance to fix it and, you know, make the record, make his prior record level be what it was supposed to be.
That's the important point here, is it looks like this additional point that the trial court assessed the second time was at the suggestion of the prosecutor, in the majority opinion at any rate, that there's any impropriety being conducted by the prosecutor in suggesting this mandatory prior record level point. So if on the second time around, you still have to do the proper calculation to get a defendant's prior record level, and that would be the takeaway moving forward.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, that's all for today. In this episode, we discussed State v. Cole, finding no error in a jury instruction on the felony disqualifier provision. State v. Williams, holding the defendant was not entitled to a mistrial due to alleged improprieties in the state's closing argument. And State v. Thomas, concluding the trial court was not barred from imposing a more severe sentence at resentencing. Turning States is a collaboration between the University of North Carolina School of Government and the North Carolina Conference of District Attorneys. We are coming to you from the recording studio at the School of Government in Chapel Hill. Our producer is Paul Bonner. Our graphic designer is Emily Hinkle. Our applications manager is Chance Fitzgerald. Our music was composed by Gustav Holtz, who, I just learned, played the trombone. If you liked what you heard today, if you have questions, comments, concerns, if there's a topic you'd like for us to cover in a future episode, please contact us. My name is Joseph Hyde, and I can be reached at jhyde@sog.unc.edu.
And I'm Jonathan Holbrook. I can be reached at jonathan.p.holbrook@nccourts.org.
Thank you, John. That would be the showing for the state.
Sounds good, Joe. Thanks. Hope it helped.